Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics, the usual two segments of today. First, in a few minutes, we'll talk with Jamie Webster of PFC Energy on the oil boom in the U.S. and the death of Hubbard's Peak. And at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from the writer and queer activist Yasmin Ayer about a project she's one of the instigators of, Against Equality, which is critical of same-sex marriage, Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and hate crimes legislation, which are all major priorities of Gay Inc., as it's sometimes called. But first, some words in the news. Since I've done a lot in recent weeks on labor unions, I've got to say that the new law in Michigan outlawing the closed shop and compulsory union dues payments is an outrage. Though hidden behind standard-issue rhetoric about freedom and choice, the intention is clearly to break the economic and political power of unions and cut wages. That this happened in the birthplace of modern unionism is chilling. But as we learned from Jane McAlevey the other week, it is possible to organize workers in right-to-work states. It requires unions to be innovative and energetic and to offer something to their members. It means turning workers into organizers and unions into social movements. There was no closed shop or compulsory dues payments when the UAW was organized in Flint in 1936-37. The fight against this legislation has the potential to inspire some real fight back. Let's hope that it doesn't result in a rerun of what we saw in Wisconsin, an influx of Democratic Party professionals, and the devolution of a popular uprising into a depressing and ultimately losing electoral campaign. And speaking of popular uprisings, though many obituaries for the Occupy movement have been written and spoken, the thing keeps showing signs of life. Students at Cooper Union in Manhattan, a school of art and engineering that has been tuition-free since 1902, have been occupying the main building, protesting the administration's decision to rescind that policy. This follows upon the Occupy Sandy hurricane relief efforts of the last month. While this sort of activism may be familiar to denizens of the Bay Area, they're unusual and very exciting in New York. Combine this with the image of thousands of people surrounding the Capitol building in East Lansing, Michigan, and I'm getting the feeling that the long period of popular torpor is giving way to something far more energetic. Let's take a musical break. Though some of Tower of Powers, there's only so much oil in the ground, which is true, but there seems to be more than we used to think. My first guest is Jamie Webster, an analyst with the D.C.-based consulting firm PFC Energy. That firm is just out with a report on what they call a reset for the U.S. energy picture. Contrary to predictions by peak oilists and other gloomsters, U.S. energy production, instead of declining, is now booming. Domestic oil production is up almost 20% over the last year to levels not seen in a couple of decades. I want to make it clear that I don't think this is a good thing. The technologies used to increase production, notably fracking, are toxic and disruptive, and burning more oil will be fatal to the climate if it isn't already mortally wounded. But they also have little patience for predictions that we're running out of this stuff. We're not, and here's Jamie Webster to tell us why. Welcome, Jamie Webster. You and your colleagues have written up a report on the reset of the U.S. energy picture. Just give us some idea of the dimension of what's underway.
Sure. So the start of unconventional production within the United States, as well as some increases in production in the offshore, has allowed the United States to move back to the position it was at in post-World War II period, which is extremely fast production growth. In fact, it's moving even faster than we showed in the late 1940s and 1950s. And then accompanied with that is the fact that we are at the same time, using less oil, and so it's giving us it is kind of changing our our balance. This is having, you know, huge implications across the energy landscape. I'm here today at OPEC, and they have, you know, they need to start having discussions on how to bring down their production. And partly this is because of the American energy reset, that you've had an increase in production. One thing that is very different about the increase in production in the United States, that is different from other sorts of production booms we've seen in the past, Brazil, North Sea, other places, is that because of the nature of the production, which is that you need to have lots and lots of wells drilled to keep production up, because you have a decline rate of around 55%. So that means if you've got 100 barrels coming out of a well at the beginning of the year, by the end of the year, it's only 45 barrels a day will be coming out of that. And so in order to keep this growth up, and we've had a huge amount of growth this year, over 600,000 barrels a day, second biggest year we've ever had in the history of the United States. In order to keep up that production growth, you have to keep drilling wells. So the implications of that is that if prices were to fall, you could actually see a decline in production very, very quickly out of the United States. This is different in that every other sort of oil production increase that you see, generally once you bring it on, it stays on. You don't generally turn it off just because prices drop, you know, $20 or $30. So it's a bit of a disruptive force potentially towards OPEC, in that, you know, it can actually bring down production as prices start to fall, and that has some implications there.
And I want to go back to the supply side in a moment, but you said something about using less oil, and I was noticing myself just the other day that gasoline demand is rather weak in the U.S. What's underway? Is this recession, something structural, high prices? What's responsible for this weaker demand?
It's a couple of things. It is demographics. You know, the American economy and our demographics are skewing older. The number of cars that people are driving is heading down. Certainly some of it was the recession. Even if you're a very well-off person, you can only drive one car. But if you don't have that job and don't need to go into the job, you aren't driving. It's more efficient vehicles. It's people starting to adjust their driving habits. Spend a fair amount of time in Washington, D.C., and generally in Washington, D.C., the politicians get quite upset when and have all sorts of press conferences when oil prices or gasoline prices go above $4 a gallon. Most Americans are generally smarter than most politicians, and you start to actually see a change in behavior at $3.50. That's when you actually start to see declines in demand. So it's a whole host of factors that is influencing things, and it is part of the reason why we are actually exporting gasoline in fairly substantial quantities. And late last year, we actually, for the first time, and maybe the first time ever, I have to look, but we became a net exporter of gasoline for a month. And that's over a period of time, we have been, you know, we are increasing the amount of fuels that we are exporting, and this is setting up a conversation that is already starting to take place on the natural gas side for LNG, but eventually we're going to have to start discussing about the U.S. energy policy regarding energy exports, and particularly crude oil.
So does this mean that the era of the Hummer is fading?
I think that faded quite some time ago. I think Americans are starting to become accustomed to the fact that prices are higher, and that they would rather spend their money on something else. So certainly, the original Hummer, you know, went out of production some years ago, and there does seem to be a shift both from a regulatory standpoint, but also just from consumer behavior to vehicles that use less fuel, which are generally a little on the smaller side.
You said something about 350 being something of a magic number on the gasoline price. There was a theory that gasoline demand was pretty inelastic to price, but evidently it is after all.
There's a certain core you can't change. I mean, if you need to get to your job, if you need to get to school, if you need to get to the store. But there are plenty of things you can do on the margin in the short term, which is, consolidating your trips so that, you know, while you're out there, you also get this, that, and the other, instead of going out four and five times, you know, some potential for carpooling, just plain driving, driving less, not taking those, you know, those summertime trips, those whole host of things. And then you also have more longer-term structural ways to handle it, which is when you get that new car, it's a little bit more efficient, doesn't use, you know, it's got a better gas mileage. You see a trend of, you know, trying to close that distance between the job and where you live. So you see it's both a short-term aspect and a longer-term change in terms of consumer behavior.
And is anything analogous going on elsewhere in the world?
Certainly this is also happening in Europe. Europe is on a kind of a demand decline. And you see a bit of a structural demand decline within Japan, although Japan and Europe are more less because of efficiencies and more just some changes in demographics, particularly for Japan, where you've got a very rapidly aging population. But for the rest of the world, you know, demand for gasoline and diesel and, you know, a whole host of fuels is growing quite strongly, and that's not going to change. I mean, these are the countries that were they have the economic growth that is happening. They've got the demographic boost, and they need more fuel every year, and that's where it's so that's where you're seeing the growth. So it's, you know, you're kind of seeing a change in terms of previously the United States was always both the biggest market and one of the fastest growing markets in terms of oil demand or oil product demand. Now it has changed in that the United States and with it Canada is the big growth area for supply, but is not even on the picture when it comes to demand. Demand is, you know, is over in Asia, which itself is having trouble with locating additional reserves and additional production out of its regions, which, you know, is going to end up impacting flows quite a bit in terms of how the kind of paths, the trade paths that oil and products take around the world.
And so the price of $80 a barrel or north of that is a fair reflection of the fundamentals of supply and demand?
Currently, yes. You know, $80 will keep things going. You do have a potential that you could see prices a bit below that for a period of time over the next several years. Our view is that you are likely being set up for a period of both lower but also, unfortunately, more volatile prices in the years to come. This is because as the United States growth starts to really impact global markets, OPEC itself is going to have a discussion to take some barrels off of the market, which is not an easy discussion for them because Iraq is growing its production and there needs to be some sort of accord between Iraq and Saudi Arabia. And if they are unable to come up with something, which at least from what I saw at today's meeting, they look like they're a long ways from it. If they don't come up with some sort of an agreement and you essentially have some overproduction, you could end up having, you know, very low prices for, you know, a period of time, but they will be very volatile. So you could, you know, you could feasibly see prices go to, you know, $50, $60, and come back up and go back down as Iraq and Saudi Arabia attempt to come up with some sort of agreement on how much to produce.
And what share of the world oil supply now comes from OPEC?
What's that? It's, you know, right now it's 31 million barrels, and total demand, you know, total supply is around 90, so it's a little under a third. Yeah.
Okay.
So it's the important one because it's the production that can actually swing. I mean, generally, global oil markets have, despite the vilification of OPEC, which was certainly warranted in the 70s when they cut us off as customers there for a period of time. But in general, the oil markets have always had a balancer, you know, so somebody that is able to bring on production when prices are high and take off production when prices are low. All of us would like low prices, but and as a consumer, and all producers would like high prices. But what all members of the kind of market would like is stable prices. And in order to get stable prices, you want to have some sort of balancer that can bring bring volumes off and on in order to keep that balance and keep prices relatively stable, of which, you know, OPEC has been a little slow about that. That's why you've seen some pretty volatile prices over the last several years. You know, we've gone in 2008 up at 147, and the following year we were down in the 30s.
We're listening to Jamie Webster of PFC Energy.
Okay, now back to the U.S. It's all about, fracking and horizontal drilling, this increase in supply, right?
Yeah, correct.
What kind of price do they need for that to be economical?
Well, that's a question that I get a lot from my clients. It's a very valid question. It is the one you want to try to understand where it is. In reality, it is about the same as asking what the cost of a home is in Berkeley, which is that, well, it depends. There's a huge range. So within the Bakken up in North Dakota, which is where a lot of our production is now coming from unconventional, you have wells that need over $140 in order to break even, and you have some wells that need only $40 a barrel to break even. So there's a huge, wide range. Where you start to see some real cutbacks in activity and by extension production is when you start getting into the $70 range, $70 and a little bit below that, then you'll start to see that. But over time, as they become more efficient and as the technology improves, hopefully that price where, you know, you start to see, you know, more production coming offline than coming online and you know, bring the growth rate down, that will improve, and so you'll see those you know, all of those prices, those break-even prices, start to come down further.
If the depletion rate is so rapid, how reliable are these projections of increased production over years?
To be frank, there's a lot of uncertainty on both the upside and the downside for U.S. production changes, and that is, you know, it's the rate of activity, it's what the initial production is out of each one. And over the last year, analysts, which are PFC Energy, my company, and others, have been in general wrong on the downside. Meaning we've said production was going to be this high, and it was actually much higher. And that has been ongoing for the last year. There is a potential that we could then correct on the downside, particularly if you start to see, you know, there is still the ongoing debate on the safety of hydraulic fracturing, which includes not just the very discrete activity of putting that horizontal well in and fracking it, but there's all of the other things that are associated with this unconventional play. It's the emissions, it's the large number of trucks that you need, it's the noise, it's, you know, there's a whole range of impacts that are felt by a community when you start to have unconventional production, gas or oil, within a county's borders.
Is it technically feasible to phase production in and out rapidly if the price rises and falls to levels that become economical and uneconomical in a short period of time?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can, you know, if you start to get, you know, a high, you know, a low price signal, you will see, and we have seen, a reduction in activity. Now, you know, the wells that are already drilled, they'll just keep on producing. It's just because of the decline rate, they matter less and less, and so you've got to keep drilling wells. But absolutely, as the price goes down, you will see activity, you know, shrink rather rapidly and a pretty quick turnaround in terms of what that means to the growth rate or the decline rate, total decline rate for the play. And if prices go up, you do have a potential to increase even a bit more, but there's not as much upside to it as there is downside. It's, you know, the difference in terms of how much production you bring on if prices are at $110 versus $140 is not that much, but there is a much bigger difference between $110 and, say, $70.
Now, our friends in the peak oil community are very skeptical about this, and you know, Hubbard developed his theory about the United States specifically, and it looks like, at least in the short term, he's been proven wrong about production here. But what about the long-term picture? Is there anything to the peak argument? It was gaining respectability a couple of years ago. How do you view it now?
Yeah, I think the theory is dead. I think it was one of these theories that it is absolutely true and is used by the industry when you are looking at a particular field of when it's, you know, it was peak hit here, and so then it's going to go down. The problem with it is then if you take Hubbard's theory and apply it to a country, you don't know what fields you are. What you are missing or what, you know, new technology may end up unlocking. So that's why it looked like Hubbard's peak was absolutely correct for the United States before. But once you brought on this sort of technology, it suddenly is wrong. And so it absolutely works when you have a field that is of a defined size and you know how big it is and you know what you're pulling out. But when you're talking about an extant area, so like a country, a county, a state, it's a little dangerous to use that. And the unconventional boom that you're seeing in the United States is certainly possible in several other countries. There are lots of countries with these sorts of resources. One of the reasons why the United States has developed first is because we've got a lot of features that allow it to to be cultivated, which is huge, you know, thousands of miles of pipeline. A regulatory environment, at the time, a very permissive regulatory environment that allowed, you know, these technologies to be developed and refined. A large service sector that has the rigs and the pipes and everything and the manpower to get things done. And most critically, which is missing in almost every country, is that landowners generally own the mineral rights under their land. And so they can gain. There's an alignment of interest. If that particular landowner is approached, they decide to do it, they gain an upside. You know, they may gain an extra payment every month by allowing the exploitation of the hydrocarbons. Whereas if you are in a country where you the government owns the mineral rights, there's no incentive, and that ends up slowing things down. Why would you allow you would fight rather hard if you knew that a rig was going to be coming onto your land and, you know, you weren't going to be getting any money or any upside to it at all. It was all downside.
And then finally, what economic implications are there for the U.S. in this growth of domestic production?
There's been a lot that has been made that this is kind of a panacea to our growth problems. And certainly you're going to see some impacts to it. It improves our net export initiative. You know, President Obama put out a net export initiative, so this will improve our trade balance a bit. It does provide some jobs, but it's not going to substantially change the national unemployment rate. There will be some industries that benefit quite strongly from it. Petrochemical industries, anything that is driven by natural gas. And for those of us that live in the United States, it means lower gasoline and electricity prices. And that means the same for businesses as well. But generally, while we don't want to pay those high prices, those are pretty small, fairly small impacts to our total spend every month. And so it's not going to move the dial significantly. There is absolutely an upside to it, but those that have, we're not of the school that see this as the panacea to cure all of the U.S.'s economic woes.
If you find that, let us know, okay?
I will.
All right, thanks a lot.
That was Jamie Webster, an analyst with PFC Energy. He was at the OPEC meeting in Vienna, which is why there was so much background noise, and he generously took the time to talk with us. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB at Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break.
How does some of the 26th of the Goldberg Variations by Bach, performed by Charles Rosen, who died early this week? He was 85 and had a remarkably rich and long career, so it's hardly a premature demise, but oh, death. Next up is Yasmin Nair. Yasmin is a writer and activist based in Chicago and one of the instigators of Against Equality, a collective whose motto is Queer Challenges to the Politics of Inclusion. They're just out with a little book, their third, called Prisons Will Not Protect You, a critique of hate crimes laws. You can find them on the web at againstequality.org. Yasmin Nair. Welcome, Yasmin. How could anybody be against equality?
That's a great question to begin with, right? Well, you know, we chose that name as an editorial collective in part to be provocative, but also really largely because the word equality has been so overused and it really has become completely meaningless. And in fact, it actually means the opposite. So equality has become the mantra of the gay rights movement, you know, gay marriage, hate crimes legislation, ending DADT. But if you look closely at those movements, you know, whether it's gay marriage or ending DADT, they all actually inscribe certain forms of inequality within them, right? So in terms of gay marriage, for instance, the argument is, if we could all just get married, we would all be equal, because then we could do things like marry for healthcare. And what we're saying is, well, what about those who don't have jobs that guarantee healthcare in the first place? What about the entire system, really, that says only couples matter? In terms of DADT and the ending of DADT, of course, we think of it in terms of war. You know, we look at the sort of the larger picture, really, which is we don't have any argument about the idea that it's wrong to exclude people from certain institutions. What we are saying is that the way equality has come to frame all these arguments is, in fact, actually about excluding those who might, for instance, dissent against the war agenda, who might actually not be able to gain health care just by marrying and shouldn't have to. For that reason, we named ourselves Against Equality.
How did what some people call Gay Inc. get so obsessed with these twin issues of don't ask, don't tell and marriage?
I think it's historically this rise in what we now know as Gay Inc. really came about in the early to mid 90s, where you had a real reconfiguration of what counted as radical gay energy, in part due to the AIDS crisis. And just the sort of, you know, what happened, I think, at that moment was that on the one hand, you had a real decimation of the queer population, but you also had a restructuring of the gay community in terms of a rise in gay nonprofits. So that's when, for instance, you saw groups like the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force and the Human Rights Campaign really gaining legislative and cultural power. So what you saw was a shift, a sort of profound sense of the neoliberal shift within the gay community, and more power by those much more powerful and often white gay men and lesbians who wanted different things, right, who were not interested in universal health care, for instance, which in fact was what groups like ACTA had originally advocated for. So what you saw in the sort of early to mid-90s is this rise of Gay Inc. and a rise in power within a community of people who wanted things that were rather different from what queers had really wanted earlier, right? So not about sexual freedom, not about universal health care, but about wanting the status quo and more of it. And then, of course, you had cases like the Hawaii marriage case, for instance, which shifted the paradigms as well. And suddenly people were looking at things like marriage as a possibility, rather than marriage as something to avoid, because after all, that was the one thing that would distinguish us, perhaps, right? So I think it really is about the professionalization of gay activism, and also I think the rise of the social justice nonprofit world in the early to mid-90s.
It seems that in the pursuit of a certain kind of normativity, the people who don't fit in get thrown under the bus. They're not married, patriotic, upstanding citizens, and therefore they're not real anymore.
Absolutely. They get thrown under the bus unless, I should add, unless they become funding categories. I work in Chicago with a group called Gender Just, for instance, and we have in the past worked on a lot of queer youth issues. And what's fascinating is that, yes, exactly, what happens to homeless queer youth is that they are among those who get thrown under the bus because they're just not counted, right, as entities worth considering. Except now they've become a great funding category. So everybody will fund a gay organization if they agree on paper to do things, quote-unquote, whatever that might mean, for queer youth, to provide services of some sort. So, yes, a lot of people get thrown under the bus, but are also exploited, I would argue, when it's useful for gangs to do so.
Your critique is also part of a larger critique of the whole nonprofit industrial complex. Could you summarize that for us?
Sure. What we have seen is that gay activism has, for I think sometimes perhaps for good reasons, right, turned to the nonprofit structure to provide a more coherent and a more, I will admit, sometimes more effective way to bring about change. So when you think about the NGLTF, for instance, the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, you know, it actually began as, I hate to use perhaps the word leftist, but certainly a much more left-oriented gay rights organization. But I think what has happened is that, you know, the NPIC is, as, you know, many people have written about it, you know, the NPIC, the nonprofit industrial complex, is really a tool of left neoliberalism, to use Walter Ben Michaels' term, right? So in that sense, it really now exists only to sustain itself, and it really also exists only to encourage projects that might, for instance, be about perhaps, at the worst, charity, but also projects that actually extend the neoliberal state, right? So extend people's dependency upon charity, perhaps, or don't actually go after systemic issues. So, for instance, when you think about the domestic violence industrial complex, you know, and that's, you know, one unto itself. There's a lot of emphasis on rescuing and on providing shelter and providing services for people after they've been abused. But they don't do a lot about really going out into communities and tackling what I think is a fundamental problem, right? This emphasis on this idea that everybody needs to be partnered in the first place. And that's just one aspect of how problematic that particular realm might be. But the NPIC, by and large, has become a wing of the neoliberal enterprise. And, you know, gay nonprofits were absolutely necessary when we started out. You know, so for instance, here in Chicago, places like the Howard Brown Health Center or even the Center on Halsted, which is much more recent, actually. But if you think about the Howard Brown Health Center, for instance, which was the only place, right, in the late 70s that would actually go out and help gay men find anonymous sources for syphilis testing, for instance. Right. So that was an absolutely necessary service. But over the years, you know, it became obvious that you couldn't just keep sustaining yourself on volunteer labor. You couldn't just ask people to pitch in as necessary. And you had to kind of turn to that kind of non-profit model. And that then became a thing unto itself. And we know this even from the sort of non-gay, straight, non-profit world out there, that the non-profit industrial complex now exists mostly simply to fund itself, and it actually has a lot of the problems that we see in corporations. So, for instance, you see this massive disparity between the salaries of CEOs and those just two rungs below them, perhaps. There's a huge amount of turnover. There's a huge amount of exploitation, underpaying people, and so on and so forth.
It sounds like the trajectory you describe is very similar to what the civil rights movement experienced, feminism experienced. It starts as a disruptive social movement and ends up as a professionalized strategy for litigation and lobbying.
Yes. Exactly. Litigation and lobbying is exactly where the gay community has gone. Yes, exactly.
And so
this is really well. Yes.
The disruptive social movement part has been forgotten.
Yes, exactly. In fact, you are highly discouraged from being a disruptive at all. I've lived on the sort of outskirts of the NPIC for a long time because of the kinds of work that I've done. Yes, and I can assure you that any time that one actually says, let's critique the system and not just try to provide band-aid solutions, one is just shut down.
But of course, then, you know, part of it is that people want to be part of the system. They've just been excluded because of race or sex or sexual preference. But they want to, like, you know, if you just bracket that, we're like everyone else.
Right. You know, if we just talk about inclusion rather than systemic change, I think that's become the mantra, right? How can we expand the categories as opposed to how can we really examine the system, right? How can we examine neoliberalism, in other words? And that has not been the question for a very long time.
We're listening to the writer and activist Yasmin Nair.
Okay, now let's turn to the Against Equality book series. You put out three little books, essays. The third just came out. Describe what these are all about.
We began as just to give a brief history, we began actually as an editorial collective in 2009. That was the brainchild of my co-founder and friend Ryan Conrad, who said to me, you know, there isn't a place on the web or anywhere where people can actually access these incredible, radical, queer critiques of gay politics and politics in general that have always existed for a long time. So it really began as just a collection of work on the web. And then we got a lot of requests from people to please make it more accessible in terms of actually compiling all of these critiques and essays into book format. You know, there is something to be said, first of all, about the bookness of the book, but also we were also quite aware that not everyone in this country has ready access to the internet, for instance, right? So for all those reasons, we decided to choose pieces from our archive, and we organized them thematically and began publishing them as books. So that began in, I think the first one was in 2010. We've since published three books. The first was about gay marriage. The second was about DADT. And the third, Against Equality, Prisons Will Not Protect You, is about the prison industrial complex and queer issues, focusing quite a bit on hate crimes legislation and sex offender registries.
Now, of course, hate crimes is one of those things, like equality, that it's hard to be against. It sounds so good. It sounds so American and apple pie. What's wrong with hate crimes legislation?
And that's exactly, you know, hate crimes legislation has a history, as you know, in the civil rights movement. It was actually, it came about in an effort to provide some form of justice, particularly for African Americans who were brutalized by crimes that were never prosecuted. So in that sense, it was an important corrective at the time. But over the years, hate crimes legislation has become just another way to increase the carceral agency of the prison industrial complex. And what that simply means is that what hate crimes legislation really does is to provide this illusion that simply putting more people in jail, expanding penalties, which I should add, can actually include the death penalty, or at the very least the threat of the death penalty, which induces confessions, right? False confessions, I might add, as well. But all of that simply increases the breadth and the scope of the prison industrial complex. So what has happened is that hate crimes legislation, the rise in the popularity of hate crimes legislation, has actually come about with a rise in the prison industrial complex. I mean, there is a direct correlationship. And what we argue in this book is that, first of all, you know, punishing hate, this very idea that somehow a crime needs to be doubly punished simply because there can be some tenuous proof that perhaps someone killed somebody because of their sexual orientation, race, whatever, that itself is problematic, but also that it does really nothing to prevent crimes. Right, so there is no data to say, you know, that someone who is a raging white supremacist, for instance, and there are lots of them out there, they're cropping up every day, someone is not going to not kill someone on account of their race simply because of the idea that there might be more of a penalty for that particular crime. We've seen that historically. That simply does not happen. And the third thing is that, you know, this book comes from a prison abolitionist perspective, and we can talk more about that as well, but essentially, we don't advocate for the expansion of the prison industrial complex. We don't believe that prisons have provided a solution. We know that prisons in the United States houses, and by prisons, I'm just talking about those that actually labeled prisons, not the quote-unquote, I'm not even adding the detention centers, which are actually prisons, but that's another story. But we know that in the United States, we have 5% of the world's population and about 25% of the world's prison population. Most of those in prison are African Americans. And although there are no numbers to, they haven't yet found any numbers. We can also say that the vast majority of them are also people who are poor, right? So the most disenfranchised on all counts are those who are most likely to end up in prison, in large part because of the way the U.S. prison system works, because of bad representation and so on and so forth, and also because of onerous laws. And this also comes about along with a rise in extraordinarily punitive and legislation like the U.S. drug laws, like the anti-sex trafficking laws, right? All of these pieces of legislation which are really designed not to actually get at the root of any problem, but to design ways in which we might entrap and put more people in jail purely by tweaking categories. So if you think about the drug wars, for instance, right, and if you think about how the category of what an offense is under those has been expanded, then it becomes obvious that it's really not about going after the system, but about going after more people to put in jail, because we're building these prisons, and for various reasons, various communities, especially lower-income communities, might feel, rural communities in particular, feel that those are the only ways that they can get more employment in their areas. And also that there are, we also feel that there are ways to deal with the systemic problems of violence and racism and so on in our communities in ways that are not instantly hooked up into the state.
Something that mystifies me, that even within the logic of the system, I mean, the people who killed Matthew Shepard and the people who killed James Byrd, what, they're facing life in prison, or in the case of Byrd in Texas, a couple of them are facing a death penalty. So, I mean, what additional punishment is the hate angle supposed to provide?
That is a question for us. Is this kind of the way in which hate crimes legislation invokes a kind of double, triple sort of punishment? You know, and our question is, what more do you want? What more do you want someone to go through? And, you know, also, I think it was Joanna Wojcicki, perhaps, who wrote for The Nation, and there was also an ABC TV show about this. You know, the circumstances under which people are willing to take on, say, life in prison because they're really threatened with a death penalty, those are very problematic as well. Because, again, do you see that that's also another way in which hate crimes legislation simply allows for the extension of the PIC. There was a case I covered here in Illinois some years ago, which had to do with the killing of a deaf gay man, which became quite a well-known case here for a little bit of time. And in that, no, that was in Ohio, I apologize. It was in Ohio, where there was actually no hate crimes legislation, at least at the time. And the prosecutor essentially got people to confess by threatening them with hate crimes legislation and the possibility of a death penalty, simply by whipping up public anger towards them. So there's a way in which hate crimes legislation, just by its mere existence, serves to compound penalties. And it compounds penalties sometimes even when it actually doesn't exist. You know, just the idea of you've committed a hate crime and therefore I can incite public anger against you makes people confess. You know, Illinois, as you might know, just recently CBS did a show, 60 Minutes just did a show about Illinois having the dubious distinction of being number one in false confessions, in coerced confessions. You know, all of this is part and parcel of this sort of hate crimes / prison industrial complex. And the people most likely to go to jail on account of hate crimes legislation are poorer people with inadequate representation, and who are also often people of color, who are often the most marginalized.
And there's a piece in the collection about how Gay Inc. was notably absent during the hysteria of the 80s and 90s, but it's even extended to more recent years, around ritual abuse, that crazy delusional phase of ritual abuse accusations. Even though these accusations were laced with homophobia, what is responsible for this missing in action?
Right, and that is, I think you're referring to James Gentremore's excellent piece about satanic abuse cases, right, The Devil in Gay Inc. What happened there was that a lot of those were about gay men who were also accused of being sex offenders and often accused of being predatory sex offenders. And this, by the way, some, and this also relates to a, James also writes about a recent case about the San Antonio four lesbians in Texas who have also been accused of similar kinds of satanic abuse. That thing just never seems to go away. I think Gay Inc. quietly disappears from the scene and refuses to have anything to do with such cases because it really is focusing on building itself up in this image of the pure, the better than criminals. I mean, it really is invested in maintaining an image of itself as a community of people who can do no wrong and who are never criminal and who cannot be criminalized. So Gay Inc. historically has never supported the efforts of many, many social justice workers and writers on the ground who have constantly asked for help, especially with these cases involving gay men. And as you know, that particular essay writes is about really horrendous instances of Gay Inc. simply when it has a lot of power and money, right, but refusing to in any way reach out to lesbians and gay men who are accused of these crimes. And that's also because historically, as you know, gay men in particular have always automatically been seen as pedophiles. There's always been that charge, right? And I think Gay Inc. and mainstream gays and lesbians are so desperate to walk away from that or to dissociate themselves from that image that historically, even if you look back at the 1950s, 60s, when these cases were also prevalent and had much more wide-reaching effects, the mainstream gay community has always been silent about them.
And finally, I always, I'm always pursuing the critical angle and always forget to be constructive. So let's conclude on a constructive note. What is a better way of approaching, let's just concentrate on anti-gay and anti-trans violence. What is a better way to approach that rather than inviting the state in?
Well, in anti-trans violence, for instance, one of the things that a lot of us are, you know, focusing on is providing a network of support and which would actually enable people to live lives outside the kinds of survival economies without being criminalized. So, for instance, with trans people, you know, there is a way in which once one comes out as trans, one is inevitably led downwards into a spiral of lost economic opportunities, rampant discrimination, and so on. And there is nothing right now. You know, ENDA does not begin to cover it because ENDA is sort of a at-the-end kind of solution. But at this point in time, there's very little that actually provides support for people who are transitioning to actually gain counseling, to gain social services, housing services, simple things, right, that would keep them safe. And that would keep them out of the reach of a predatory street economy. And this is not to obviously dismiss street economies, but it's simply to say that they can be dangerous for many people. So our point is that instead of simply looking at the end point, what Gay Inc. does in particular is to look at trans murders, for instance, as ways to whip up more support for hate crimes legislation and to whip up more support for putting people in jail. What we're saying is instead of doing that, have a looking at how various social service agencies, for instance, the Center on Halsted here in Chicago, have failed the trans community, do not provide the kinds of resources they claim to be providing on paper, for instance, engage in the kind of stigmatizing of sex work and street economies that are, in fact, deeply harmful to those people engaging in that kind of work. The difficulty is of living in a neoliberal, and I don't want to end on a negative note, but the difficulty is of living in a profoundly neoliberal city that constantly privatizes responses and also at the same time pushes people into the prison industrial complex simply because there's so much at stake in keeping that alive. But there is tremendous pushback. I think the issue is to keep that momentum going and to keep pushing back at that system and to say that prison is not the answer. Prisons will not protect you, in other words.
That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Eden Prison, a live version from the ever-cheerful Swans. Till next week, bye.